This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, Bridgegate. Has Chris Christie done enough to rescue himself from the Fort Lee bridge scandal? Also, Republican politicians rediscover compassionate conservatism. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, food critics come out of the shadows. Will getting rid of anonymity help or hurt restaurant reviews? Then, we consider how well Isaac Asimov predicted life in 2014, 50 years ago. And then, the new movie Her imagines a passionate relationship between a real man and a digital girlfriend.
Like, are these feelings even real? Or are they just programming?
You feel real to me, Samantha.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. An embarrassed and humiliated Chris Christie this week insisted that he knew nothing of the political dirty trick played by his staffers against the people of Fort Lee, New Jersey. Will Christie's Bridgegate apology be enough to save his 2016 presidential ambitions? Then Marco Rubio's got a poverty plan. Paul Ryan has a poverty plan. Are Republicans getting serious about helping the poor? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New York City, Slate senior editor, Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
I come out here today to apologize to the people of New Jersey. I apologize to the people of Fort Lee, and I apologize to the members of the state legislature. I am embarrassed and humiliated by the conduct of some of the people on my team.
So that was, of course, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. These days, political scandals are so mundane, so dreary.
And fake.
Yeah, it's like an affair here, a misplaced tweet there, small fake indignation about something. And then something comes along to restore your faith in humanity, and that something is the Fort Lee bridge scandal. This week brought news that Chris Christie's top aides retaliated against Democratic mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, who had declined to endorse Christie just before this year's gubernatorial election. And they retaliated by snarling traffic into Fort Lee on the George Washington Bridge, delaying school buses for hours, delaying emergency vehicles. On Thursday, in a remarkable and Fidel Castro-length press conference, Christie announced that he had fired the main aide involved in this wrongdoing, Bridget Ann Kelly, who was his deputy chief of staff, and that a whole bunch of other people were also out. Mostly they were folks at the Port Authority who'd already resigned, an aide of his who was about to go work with him at the Republican Governors Association. And he said that he knew nothing about this effort to shut the bridge down. Emily, do you believe that Chris Christie knew nothing about the effort to shut the bridge down?
I believe that he won't be caught with his fingerprints on it. I don't believe that this would have happened without any knowledge of his, because he seems like a guy who likes to know what's going on in his administration and has a streak for taking revenge. There have been lots of examples of that collected. The notion that his aides would just up on their own and do this just seems totally implausible to me.
Do you think it's totally implausible, John?
There are two questions. One is whether he really knew about it. I think it's plausible that he didn't. What is less plausible and yet still interesting and still tells us something about Christie is that this would have been a flower that bloomed in totally arid land, which is to say that there wasn't a culture in which this could take place, either that inspired the initial thought or that somebody could think that they would be able to get away with doing this. And just to put it in context, the George Washington Bridge is the busiest bridge in the world. So this wasn't like shutting off like a dead end alley in Hoboken. Secondly, the mayor being punished here, Christie was going to win this race by, you know, double digits. He had 60 mayors already supporting him, Democratic mayors supporting him. And the point was that he wanted to run up the score, show that he had bipartisan appeal as a platform for launching his presidential desires. So you need more Democrats, but that's a pretty small prize. To shut down two lanes onto the most used bridge in the world for this tiny little prize, it's hard to believe that if you were that reckless with your political vindictiveness, that that was the only way in which you'd done it. You know, if you're caught like firing a six shooter around the house, you don't just do that the first time. You've probably become sort of habituated to it. And so then that means there are going to be other shoes to drop. And when they drop, then the question goes back to Christie. How does this happen? Either he doesn't know or he allows it and it creates a culture of that. And that's a problem for him.
David, do you think he doesn't know?
So there are three options. One, he knows, and there's a lot of omerta, and just he's counting on everyone to fall on their sword and not to reveal that they told him about it. That seems to me unlikely. There's the he didn't know at all, but he allows an atmosphere that's so loosey-goosey and vindictive to flourish that it happened, but he genuinely was surprised to hear that it happened. And then there's the in-between option, which is that he didn't know explicitly and he made no explicit orders to this effect, but it was clear like they wanted something bad to happen to the mayor of Fort Lee.
All
of these options are problematic for him, but I would probably lean towards somewhere between he didn't know at all and he knew that something was going to happen to Fort Lee, but he wasn't going to have his fingerprints on it, and that he was actually surprised when it...
Will no one rid me of this troublesome mayor of Fort Lee?
Yeah. Yes, very good. Nice reference. Who will rid me of him? He did say that he had this meeting with his staff 4 weeks ago when he asked them about it and confronted them, and they all lied to him. So that meeting surely took place. If that meeting didn't take place, we are going to find out, right?
Right.
So that does suggest that he actually might have been surprised by this. But that still doesn't excuse him for operating in an office where people feel they can freelance this kind of vindictiveness.
Well, and the political peril for him is that this, again, to use this fertility metaphor in another tortured way in another context, this episode lands on fertile ground, which is that Christie has a public reputation of being a tough guy. I mean, they put up YouTubes of him, you know, in his public confrontations. And so for a long time, there have been two sides to Chris Christie. One is the tells it like it is, honest, straightforward, no BS guy. And then the flip side of that is that he's a bully. And there's always been this, is he or isn't he? Is he or isn't he? And this gives an incredibly easy and cinematic anecdote to the he's a bully side.
Right. Except his excuse is, I'm not a bully, I'm incompetent.
Right,
exactly. Which isn't so good. But I think also, David, to go back to the idea that that rid me of this troublesome mayor, if you were an aide and you weren't directed by the governor to do this, but you did it anyway, you must have been imagining bringing it back to him, like, you know, you were the cat bringing the lovely mouse to your owner. There must have been some sense that this was going to be praised and valued. Otherwise, why would you do it? And this is just aside from the fact that they picked such an incredibly boneheaded way to take revenge because there were so many people involved.
I mean, there is something about having power and being able to kind of pull the wings off flies for its own delight. And let's say you're pissed at the mayor of Fort Lee and you have the power to do this, so screw him. And, you know, helps.
You not being Chris Christie.
Sorry, you being this deputy chief of staff.
You're David Wildstein.
Yeah, and so it is in the service of the reelection campaign of this guy you love, but you're also just kind of getting your kicks. And if it's true about power and absolute power corrupting absolutely, I guess I could imagine a situation in which they were doing it for their own kicks.
I actually confess that I am a little bit bummed that this scandal is going to be so damaging. The thing that I love about politics in Chris Christie world is that politics is, in fact, something where you can give people incentives, you can negotiate, you can trade, you can use the tools of politics to get things done. And some of those tools are ugly. Some of them are intimidation. Some of them are effective bribery. That kind of greasing makes politics work.
But wait, David, we're not talking about greasing. We're talking about punishing.
But punishing is part of greasing.
Right.
If you grease, you also have to be able to punish. To say that no, politics needs to be above that is to misunderstand the nature of politics, which is you have to be able to give things and take things in order for stuff to get done because people don't all have the same interests. So you have to incentivize them the way you incentivize all people with money, threats, you know, opportunities.
But do all forms of retaliation have to be on the table? I mean, Christie's also
It was a stupid form of retaliation. That's the problem. Right. It was incredibly stupid.
Not just stupid. One that also hurt a lot of other people.
Yes, right. That's why it was stupid.
Yeah.
No, but my point is just that it's one thing to say to someone, oh, you can't have that, you know, commission appointment you wanted, or I'm going to take away your vanity security services, which Christie did to someone he was mad at. It's another thing to involve thousands of people in hours of sitting waiting to get onto the GW bridge.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I totally buy David's argument and think it's right, which is not that this was bad, oh, it's bad, but it was a poorly executed right. use of right. that. If you want to hire somebody who's good at using political pressure and power, hire someone who's better at it, which means A, not getting caught, and B, part of the reason it was caught, they were caught, is because they did it in a super stupid way that affected lots of people
right.
for a super small gain, right?
Right. Right. What I'm bummed about, Emily, is that this discredits the idea of power politics, retaliatory politics, incentive politics for a bad cause, right?
Yeah, but are you really worried that incentive and retaliatory politics
yes.
is going to be gone forever? Yes. They're not endangered species.
This is one of the things that is so troubling about what's happened in Washington, is that there are so few tools left to compel politicians to do things. With earmarks gone, you can't actually bribe a Republican legislator to vote for some bill because you're not allowed to earmark that legislation.
See, now I feel like you're conflating Washington and its sclerosis and problems with local and regional politics, in which there is still lots of corruption, bribery, retaliation, revenge. That is the name of the game, and I can't imagine it going away. Not New Jersey.
You're right. But insofar as we appreciate and admire politicians for their ability to get things done, they often are able to get things done because they are able to use these tools of power politics to do it. And I would like to have some governor come to Washington and be able to grease things and get his legislation passed because he understands how to incentivize people. And sometimes incentivizing them is playing dirty with them.
What should be basically an experience attribute, your ability at the local level or the governor's level to use the powers and tools, some of them slightly unsavory, of your job to get things done, that should be like a prerequisite for coming to Washington. But now this has the potential of making it even more toxic so that we end up looking for only like, you know, one-term senators who just give good speeches and have never actually
right.
done anything.
Exactly.
See, I just feel like you guys are doing all this hand-wringing that's just not warranted. I mean, if David, you're disappointed that Chris Christie may be tarnished as a candidate because you like him, that's okay, that's fine. But the notion that we are suddenly not going to be interested in having former governors come to be president, that just seems totally overblown to me.
I just feel like this righteousness about, oh, you shouldn't retaliate, it's shocking that he would retaliate, and we need a politics that's better than that, is totally wrongheaded.
But it's not going to last. It has no, it's like
it's going to last in the sense that Chris Christie is not going to be able to use this tool as governor anymore.
So that's what's making you really sad, is that Chris Christie doesn't get to close more bridges? I mean, come
and
on.
And the Republican Party is going to be like, oh, we can't have this kind of corruption. We have to have politicians who are idealistic and principled in our ranks. And it's like, no, you shouldn't have politicians who are idealistic and principled. You should have politicians who are dirty. Dirty
right,
politicians.
Except that I don't
better.
Think you want to, or maybe you do, but are you going so far as to say, well, actually, Christie should say, this is what qualifies me for higher office?
Well, no, because on
sloppiness grounds. Because he did it stupidly.
Grounds. Yeah, right. I mean, that was the promise of Christie before all of this, which is that, you know, people, at least in New Jersey, and the big open question was whether outside of New Jersey people would see this as charming or not, but that people were willing to not only forgive his brusqueness, but see it as almost an attribute because it got some things done. So I think this is actually the kind of thing in a general election context where you have swingish voters wondering about abuse of power and what he would be like in the White House. Those people with sort of tender, more suburban women with, I'm thinking about, who tend to be swing voters, being slightly
like
more
suburban,
offended by this, maybe.
Suburban woman voter.
Suburban.
She damns you with your suburbanness.
Coming up, why are Republicans suddenly so interested in poverty? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Poverty, it's not just for Democrats anymore. The Republican Party, the favorite party of billionaires and corporations, has discovered the poor. They're no longer talking about the 47 percenters. Some in the GOP are taking the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty and the terrible rise in inequality and the crisis over unemployment insurance to start talking tentatively about how to help the poor. Paul Ryan, former vice presidential candidate and House leader, is emphasizing the role of volunteerism and voluntary organizations in helping people deal with poverty. Marco Rubio announced a grand plan this week where he was going to propose block granting all poverty programs and then replacing the earned income tax credit with kind of a wage supplement that poor people would get to their federal supplement to their wages. Conservative pundits, including Ross Douthat, are batting around ideas changing the way health insurance is done to make it easier for poor people to get it, giving a bigger tax incentive for having children. Emily, the Republican Party has gone wildly libertarian in the past couple of years, very anti-government, very skeptical of government assistance. They are much less interested in helping people. As the recession has hit, they've become much less interested in helping the downtrodden and the long-term unemployed, for example. How can the two strains of republicanism, the kind of compassionate conservatism strain, be reconciled with the general libertarian do-it-yourself strain in the party?
Well, I think they would vehemently dispute that they don't want to help poor people and the downtrodden. They would say that the way to help people is by giving them an incentive to go to work and better themselves. So Ross Douthat in particular was writing about, you know, people relocating because there are parts of the country in which the unemployment rates are down. And then other kind of incentive shapers, right, where you, like you said, if you have a lot of kids, you get a bigger tax break, that there are things that are not the government providing services, but ways in which government can encourage behavior that conservatives want to see more of, encourage bootstrapping. The problem is, I just don't see how you take this very far in a concrete way, because the government's never proven itself very good at, you know, retraining people, for example. The thing about unemployment insurance, long-term unemployment insurance, welfare payments, food stamps, like, these are concrete things that you can give to people. They're much easier to manage than, you know, improving the whole economy so that there are lots and lots of $15 or $20 an hour jobs, which is what the Republicans seem to want, right? I mean, the argument they're making against the minimum wage is we shouldn't want a world in which lots and lots of people have $10 an hour jobs. Well, yes, we should if people have no dollar jobs at all, right? I mean, there's like this reality check always here for me that I don't quite get.
I talked to Jim Wallace this week, who's the founder of Sojourners Magazine and who's been trying to do some work, has worked his whole life on issues with the poor and trying to create different kinds of coalitions to get action on the poor. And there were a couple of interesting things that he said. One, he's worked with Michael Gerson, the former speechwriter for President Bush, who he met when President Bush called Wallace and a bunch of other faith leaders down to Austin and basically said, look, I don't know poor people. Bush had this huge compassion agenda. I went back and looked at Bush's, the collection of all his policy papers from the campaign, which is itself a rare document that you'd have campaign, a book of policy papers. The Romney campaign had no such item. You know, there are about 80 pages on Bush's compassion agenda. And this was a major part of his campaign and his presidency before the war. What Wallace and Gerson tried to do was to say, look, there are a lot of crossover areas where liberals and conservatives can put together an agenda for the poor. And Wallace's argument is that liberals need to recognize that family and values are a part of lifting people out of poverty, and that conservatives have to stop saying that the safety net is just a hammock. Basically, they tried to put together this coalition, and he said what stops people from embracing it even at the smallest levels is that no one, and you saw it in Marco Rubio's speech, nobody will take the step out of their ideological camp to embrace something in the middle, because the purchase price for having a poverty agenda is that you must say the safety net's been a disaster, that, as Marco Rubio said, that the 50 years of the war on poverty have failed. You have to kind of show that you're holier than thou on the kind of fiscal sanity and fiscal conservatism before you can then talk about these issues. But if that's your opening bid, if you have to show that you are not some kind of lefty, then the programs that you can support are necessarily always circumscribed. I remember covering Jack Kemp in 1996 when he went to Sylvia's Kitchen in Harlem, and when we went to Watts and went to the south side of Chicago. It was very odd, right, to be at a Republican event in those neighborhoods. And Kemp was really talking about how you could get to poverty through these conservative ideas. And basically the Dole campaign was like, this guy's nuts. He's not getting us any votes. And it was considered a sort of emblematic of his contributions to the campaign, which is just like they're way off out there. John McCain tried a poverty tour in 2008 that nobody paid any attention to, because you just can't get any traction because you're ultimately so circumscribed.
I think if you look at poverty in the context of immigration, which is another issue where it would seem there's a lot to be done. Lots of people have, on both parties, agree on general principles, and yet the Republican Party still will not bite the bullet, will not actually push for a passable reform on it.
Although there may be enough pressure in the system this year. And one interesting thing Wallace talked about was he said that there were some conservatives who wanted to support immigration reform. And basically, it looks like the path for immigration reform is that it's going to be a series of smaller measures that the House will agree to. And the president has said he might embrace that approach. And then the question is, what included in those smaller measures will you have some kind of path to citizenship and how will it be
arranged?
Right,
but I guess, on the immigration, there's an obvious reason Republicans would do that, to get votes. Like there do seem to be huge potential vote gains to make, in the sense that you make yourself slightly more right with Hispanics than you are now. With the poor, it doesn't appear, it's not at all clear to me why Republicans would ever bother to talk about it, because there's a core of poor people who do vote for Republicans. They're very conservative. White, poor conservatives do vote for Republicans. But they're not the voting bloc that they care about.
Well, but they're not going after actual poor people. They're going after middle-class people who they worry will be turned off if they seem utterly indifferent to poor people.
So this is... Go ahead, John.
Well, no, I was just going to say, one of the things that Wallace talked about that I wonder if it's a model is that he said when conservatives were trying to find a way to support immigration reform, he said... What he did is he has a coalition with both leaders, Christian leaders on the left, but also the Southern Baptist Convention and evangelicals on the right. And basically, the evangelicals in the districts of these members gave them cover, because evangelicals believe from a faith perspective in immigration. So they helped give cover to these conservative Republicans who were trying to get to yes on immigration, but who were being attacked from certain other elements of the conservative coalition. And so Wallace was trying to figure out if there's a way to do that on poverty. And I think the argument, David, for wanting to help the poor is that there are a lot of Republicans who come to this from the faith perspective and think that, as John Kasich said, you know, when you go to St. Peter, he's not going to say, how much did you shrink government? He's going to say, what did you do for the least among us? And so that's where the thrust would come for a lot of Republicans who, for whom faith is the most important thing in their lives.
But then on the other hand, whenever you have corporate interests aligned on the other side, these are the politicians who side with those interests. And the minimum wage fight is a perfect example of that.
Right. On the minimum wage, on unemployment insurance, and on food assistance, which they're going to cut $9 billion more dollars out of food assistance. Republicans want to cut $40 billion more dollars out of food assistance.
I mean, what does St. Peter have to say about that?
Well, you don't know what St. Peter's policy arguments are. In other words, the minimum wage doesn't necessarily, in everyone's mind, equal help for the poor.
Right.
I mean,
nor does food assistance, nor does unemployment insurance. There is a theory, but it's a wrong theory, that this disincentivizes people. That people really should go out and forage for food better.
Well, I don't know if they think that the alternative is only foraging for food, but I think what does lock people in is what Wallace talks about, which is that if you even were to support something kind of more in the middle of the road, that you wouldn't even be allowed that, and they have to find.
But you know, it seems to me that this conversation has shifted in a way that is different from what we're talking about. If we were talking about welfare, cash handouts, this was the argument against welfare that really gained traction. But does it really make sense to have the same objections to raising the minimum wage, which helps people who are working? And then, you know, food stamps, I guess you can see them as a handout. On the other hand, we're talking about something really basic here. We're talking about eating. Not, you know, lining your pockets.
Well, food stamps and unemployment insurance, both you can paint as government handing people money so that they can sit around and laze and play video games and not work.
Yeah, unemployment insurance is the strongest point, right? Because even though it's a very small amount, it could keep you from doing something like moving to a state where there are jobs because you're subsisting.
Even though it doesn't really do that.
Right.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Her is the new Spike Jonze movie about the romance between a man and an operating system. And then 50 years ago, the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov estimated what life would be like 50 years in the future. Do the math. That's us. We'll revisit those predictions today. And finally, Adam Platt, the wonderful food critic for New York Magazine, has thrown off the yoke of anonymity, and we'll ask him why. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
Welcome back. You were vacating, weren't you?
I was totally vacant, vacuous, and vamoosed.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you back. And Dana Stevens, of course, is Slate's film critic. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
Dana, I'm dying to ask you what you thought of this movie. I can't wait to talk about it. But let me set it up a little bit. Spike Jonze is the director of Being John Malkovich and Adaptation. His new movie stars Joaquin Phoenix as a lonely man in the midst of a painful divorce who takes solace in video games, gadgets, and its implied internet porn. He's a stand-in for all of us in the age of social media. He's able to connect but not connect, right? When he downloads a super advanced and supple new software, more AI than OS, it takes on a hummy, breathy voice of a young woman, and he begins to fall in love. This movie is being swooned over, Dana. I think we can both agree on that. Critics are dizzy, dizzy, dizzy. But before we find out whether you agree with that consensus, whether you're just, you know, lazing about on the hump of the bell curve on this one, Dana, let's listen to a clip from the film.
So what was it like being married?
Well, that's hard for sure. But there's something that feels so good about sharing your life with somebody.
How do you share your life with somebody?
Well, we grew up together. I used to read all of her writing all through her master's and PhD. And she read every word I ever wrote. We were a big influence on each other. I still find myself having conversations with her in my mind. Hashing old arguments and defending myself against something she said about me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Last week, my feelings were hurt by something you said before that I don't know what it's like to lose something, and I found myself...
I'm sorry I said that.
It's okay. I caught myself thinking about it over and over, and then I realized that I was simply remembering it as something that was wrong with me. That was a story I was telling myself, that I was somehow inferior. Isn't that interesting? The past is just a story we tell ourselves.
The voice of the operating system is voiced by the actress Scarlett Johansson. Diana, that's a pretty representative clip from this movie, right? It's all about her taking on an interior life and him connecting with this supposedly non-existent bit of the ether. What do you think of this movie? Did you swoon?
I guess I was one of the swooners. I mean, it's on my top 10 list for the year. I think there's a lot of critiques that could be made of it, and I sort of hope one of you didn't like it, because I would love to have a debate about it. But I was pretty much seduced by the whole thing. I mean, overhearing that clip, I heard one of the things I didn't like about it, which is I think there was some soundtrack overkill. The soundtrack is actually quite beautiful, a lot of kind of indie rock and, you know, that very kind of ambient stuff that Spike Jonze and his ex-wife Sofia Coppola in her movies also specialize in. So there was some soundtrack overkill in that clip, but I thought the dialogue was great. Cinematography was fantastic. Joaquin Phoenix's performance is one of the most intense of the year. I mean, he's on screen alone virtually every minute interacting with this disembodied off-screen voice, and he completely holds it. I mean, you guys go ahead and tear it down, and then I'll say some more. But yeah, I'm a swooner.
Wow. Okay, Julia, what do you think of this movie? Are you going to dissent from the critical consensus here? Are you going to show some daring?
I will oblige Dana with mild dissent on the subject. I liked this movie, but I didn't love this movie. I think in part because I can't really deal with mopey brooders. I'm just not that into mopey brooders. And this movie is like one gigantic mopey brood-a-thon with Joaquin Phoenix as the mopeiest brooder of all time. It's beautiful. I mean, never has mopey brooding been so lush and beautifully colored. And I really enjoyed the movie's vision of the future, which I thought was dystopic in a really subtle and interesting way. I mean, I think it was actually, it's much darker than it first seems in ways that are really interesting and thought-provoking, because it looks so similar to our own universe still.
If anything, it looks utopic, right? I mean, it starts off in a future that seems to be sort of problem-free.
Right. But it's only as you begin to untangle how the society works that you see how dark it is. But I'm not sure that I fundamentally cared about Joaquin Phoenix's mopey broody relationships with the various other women in the movie as much as I needed to fully be transported by this film.
But to me, it didn't strike me that romantic drama was the movie's primary concern. I mean, it is in form a romantic drama, and the story of his letting go of his ex-wife, the real woman played by Rooney Mara, and then connecting at first, you know, intensely and intimately, and then later, you know, in a very sort of lonely and desperate way with this operating system played by Scarlett Johansson. But to me, it seemed like a movie of ideas more than a movie of emotions. At least the first time I saw it, I think it struck me that way. What do you think, Steve? Were you moved at any point?
Well, it's funny that you should say that about it being a movie of ideas. I actually found the movie quite, in some ways, didactic and therefore kind of predictable. I didn't actually love the movie, but I want to start on a positive note because I loved some things about it enormously. The first is that how many movies have been made ever that are truly about the work of mourning that a person has to do in the face of a divorce, in the process of getting a divorce? I racked my brains. Divorce features and has featured in American movies for 40 years now prominently. And yet I felt that his broody mopiness and the broody mopiness of the movie was really well earned because it's very much a grief story about a marriage breaking up. I also really loved the production design of the movie because I think it was actually quite clever in addition to being beautiful because it was appealing. Its surface appeal was enormous, but it was also very alienating and cold as you started to inhabit it. And my feeling was that the film was designed to look like a tech ad, where what's being advertised isn't simply the product, but a way of being in the world that's mediated by devices and connectivity. It captured that mood very beautifully and very eerily. And in that regard, I like the fact that she was a recognizable celebrity voice. One interesting fact of this movie is that she was initially voiced during the entire production of the film by the actress Samantha Morton, who's a tremendously good actress. And it just, for whatever reason, I don't know that I've read a reason, apparently didn't work. And in post-production, they subbed in Scarlett Johansson's voice. My wife, for example, felt that that was off-putting. I didn't at all. I thought that that made it feel more like the kind of advertisement for a way of being and living that one sees routinely and you're listening to it and you're like, whose voice is that? That's Matt Damon's voice. I felt that that was of a piece of what the movie was about. That said, I feel like this is a kind of a quote-unquote get-it movie. You're supposed to get it, and once you get it, you're supposed to reward yourself for having gotten it.
What's the it that you're supposed to get?
You're supposed to get that this is a very pointed look at our relationship to technology and how it's supplanting our capacity for intimacy with one another. But I felt that failed for me both as romance and satire. I didn't find the romance between him and the device inherently romantic or interesting, and I didn't find the satire that pointed or that sharp. I feel like what people want from technology isn't intimacy. What they want is power.
Well, I completely disagree. I mean, the image of, you know, this futuristic city, it's actually shot in Shanghai, interestingly made to look like L.A. You know, I think a lot of those outdoor scenes were Shanghai.
Yes, but there were some telltale Chinese characters on the sides of the L.A. Metro system.
Oh, really? Oh, I missed that. Yeah, but you couldn't quite tell where you were, right, in this kind of non-place of the near future. But one detail of the near future as envisioned in this movie was completely familiar, which was, you know, this world of people walking around connected to their devices, you know, which it becomes clear in the future that essentially everyone is at all times, you know, either talking to another person or talking to some kind of machine on a device. And I felt like that was, I mean, insofar as there was a satire embedded in every scene of the movie, it was that. At the same time, I think this movie's critique of technology is pretty complicated because in the second half, as their relationship starts to fracture in some ways, there's also some question of the, you know, singularity, you know, about the evolution of technology and what the future of consciousness will be. And that's, for me, when it became a movie of ideas as much as a movie of emotions.
The movie is Her, directed by Spike Jonze, starring Joaquin Phoenix, the voice of Scarlett Johansson, Amy Adams, and others. Coming up, how important is anonymity to a restaurant reviewer? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page just for you, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. Moving on, apropos of our previous discussion about the movie Her, the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, on the occasion of the World's Fair in Queens in 1964, wrote up a set of predictions about what the world would look like in 2014, our current year. He published those speculations in the New York Times, and they've recently been making the internet rounds. Julia, among other things he didn't really predict was the internet itself. People seem surprised at how right he was. Some people seem surprised at how wrong. Some have pointed out he's basically an upper-middle-brow version of the Jetsons. Julia, what'd you make of it? What did you think he got right? What did he get wrong? And what do you make of this kind of predicting?
It's always so interesting to look back on past predictions of the future. I mean, so much so that now it has its own little internet genre name of paleofuturism. And this particular set I enjoyed because it was a great hodgepodge between being almost absurdly specifically right about a number of things, like the rise of lab-grown meat, which some people would find off-putting, or driverless cars, and then being pretty fundamentally wrong about how human and social mores would evolve in response to those things. So he pointed out that our population would grow about as much as it has, and then assumed that accordingly we would all be obsessed with population control, birth control, population growth, which is not actually something that's a large cultural meme at the moment, I don't think, but perhaps because climate change has kind of taken over as the primary apocalyptic concern. And there's another great aside where he talks about, as part of this concern about population, there would be like a huge emphasis on birth control methods, and that the imagined World's Fair of 2014 would be full of like videos and movies about birth control. And then there's a parenthesis that's like, you know, with special limited screenings for teenagers, with the idea that teenagers would still be as innocent in 2014 as they putatively were in 1964 and would need guidance through the dark, mysterious, and unknown world of sex, as opposed to having it thrust into their faces from when they were 7-year-olds watching Britney Spears videos. To me, that just was like touchingly naive and innocent and reassuring, I think, that no matter how much you can get right, sort of the future course of how humans will change is fundamentally unknowable.
Dana, what do you think? What'd you make of Mr. Asimov's predictions?
Well, one thing that was interesting to read is that it was the predictions of a utopianist, right? And he's known among science fiction writers as being the guy who's utopic rather than dystopic and trying to imagine a positive future. So a lot of these Jetsons-like images were very amusing to look back on. And it really strikes me that for such a long time, the vision of the future has always included this fantasy of flight, and it's sort of very endearing. It's the whole "I was told there'd be jetpacks" kind of logic. And so there's a lot of that there'll be hovercrafts and they'll be moving sidewalks on the street, if only, right? We could just sort of relax and moving sidewalk our way from building to building. But really, the two hugest changes, I think, to contemporary culture that he doesn't quite predict. He sort of jabs around at the idea of a screen that would
have your books and your movies.
You could talk to people on the phone and you would also have information. So yeah, he does sort of gesture toward the internet, but he doesn't seem at all to grasp how radically that would change the world and how could one have.
Right. And the other thing he doesn't anticipate is the backlash, right? The one vision of the future that always exists and doesn't seem appealing and never seems to materialize is like prepared food, the like you push a button and it serves you clam chowder version of the future. I mean, obviously we have like TV dinners and this or that, but the kind of Star Trek Jetsons version of prepared food. And Asimov is funny about it. He anticipates like that we'll all just be pushing buttons to spit out our dinner, but there will be some corner of the kitchen that you maintain for entertaining to have more customized kitchen prep. Meanwhile, if you think about the rise of slow food and the kind of complete obsessive, porny food and cooking culture that is au courant among a certain class set these days, that's a total backlash to the technology. Similarly, we've got, you know, the rise of the craft space. I mean, there's an emotional cultural response to the kinds of changes that he talks about that he fails to anticipate completely.
Right. I mean, the prediction that he could have made that would have blown us all away is if he had said the average kitchen in America now is, you know, I pick a figure, is 275 square feet. And in 50 years in the future, it'll be the defining social space and it'll be 4 times bigger. That would be an incredible prediction. It would have nothing to do with technology and have everything to do with manners. And I think that's, Dana, the essence of my indifference to these kinds of surveys, either prospectively or retrospectively, is that we essentially live in a world mediated by our relationships to others and ourselves, you know, otherwise known as kind of a world of manners, right? And futurists don't kind of by definition deal in that kind of prediction.
Well, I didn't know this term paleofuturism, but I mean, reading this Asimov 50-year-old time capsule of what would the future be like really says more about the difficulty of predicting the future than it does about, you know, Asimov's rightness or wrongness, in that when you're predicting the future, there's two ways you can go, right? I mean, what you were saying about food and food production, he's talking about something that's far closer to the mid-century production of food than nowadays, right? The automat and, you know, the astronaut tubes of food and, you know, the excitement about freezing food after the Second World War. So he's taking a current trend and extrapolating into the future, which is one form of prediction. But of course, the more interesting form of prediction and the more difficult kind is to say, well, where are things going to swerve off, or where are things going to go back, or, you know, where will older values be readopted again and valorized and all of that stuff.
Right. And so in her, right, the vision of the future we just discussed, we see a vision of the world that has like all the trend lines heading forward, with the possible exception of pants and seams. Basically, everything we do and use is going to just keep going. But the one wild veering is the creeping ever northward, ever sternumward of the waistband of one's pants. Also, no belts in the future. They just stay up, beltless, very high under the ribcage.
All right, well, moving on. Adam Platt is the restaurant critic for New York Magazine, and the magazine's most recent issue is part of an annual food roundup. Mr. Platt, in effect, outed himself, saying that he would no longer strive for anonymity when visiting restaurants. This is just the sort of little shift in manners we love to detect and discuss on the show, so we invited Mr. Platt on the show. Adam, welcome. So glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, when we have people come into the show, we always make them talk about what they had for breakfast to do their mic check. And I feel like typically that's the sort of thing we leave on the cutting room floor. But since you are a food maestro, tell us what you had for breakfast.
Well, you know, food maestros, when they are off duty, don't tend to eat that lavishly. So I had for breakfast officially a toasted frozen sesame seed bagel with cream cheese and about 17 cups of coffee.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, the cobbler's child is never shod. Why don't we begin by talking about just the history of anonymity? There's obvious reasons why a food critic for a powerful publication wouldn't want to be recognized by the staff or the chef of a restaurant that they're reviewing. Nonetheless, there's a lot of fun legend surrounding the history of disguises from Ruth Reichel to you name it, Craig Claiborne, on and on and on. Adam, talk about the history of anonymity and what steps you took to stay clandestine.
Well, the history, you know, I took over for Gail Green a long time ago. Gail Green is a longtime critic for New York Magazine. And Gail, she had I think the different critics in those days had different kinds of anonymous props, and Gail's thing was her hats. And she invited me to go to a sort of a meet and greet lunch with her at a very fancy French restaurant. And I expected to see this woman wearing this large hat. Of course, hats disguise you, but if you wear these large hats in restaurants, you will probably be the only person doing that. Anyway, that was her thing. And, I think some critics are more disguise friendly than others.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think I ever was, being 6'6" and weighing, you know, in a greatly fluctuating range between 280 and 250 pounds. It was very difficult for me to even imagine trying a disguise, let alone putting one on. But in those days, I mean, the great Ruth Reichel was really the critic that was most famous for her disguises. And she wrote endlessly about him. And the famous review that she wrote, which I'm sure you know about, is her review of Le Cirque, and where she wrote really sort of two reviews, one of her going as Ruth Reichel and one of going as a frumpy lady who was sat in the corner. They didn't pay attention to her. And the brilliance of that review was that it showed up the truth about the grand restaurants of those days, and even today, and that is that when they open for the first 3 months, they treat everybody like a critic, especially in New York. The stakes are very high. They're looking for you. Chances are if they're looking for you, they're going to spot you. But after that first 3 months, they pay more attention to the people who will bring the money, which is their regulars. Anyway, she was the most famous disguised person. These days, I don't really know who uses disguises, certainly in New York. I don't know.
Well, I've certainly seen, I love eating out in restaurants in New York, and I was a longtime frequenter of Momofuku-san, where if you passed the stairwell down to the stairs on your way to the restrooms, you could see just like mug shots, like wanted posters. They have all your faces up there, so that every server and everybody who's there has a bead on you. I don't think I saw yours. Maybe yours had been harder to find recently.
Yeah, I don't. They were not until recently, until, you know, whatever it was, 2 weeks ago. There weren't a lot of pictures of me on the internet. However, because of my appearance, and also because I've been doing it for so long now, I've been doing it for over a decade. I mean, if you're an aspiring chef and you don't really know what I look like, there's something wrong.
I mean, can you tell when you've been clocked at a restaurant? Can you tell when you're getting service that's a little bit amped up?
Yeah, you can tell when, I think I describe it in the piece I wrote, there's this sort of strange, it's not strange, but it's sort of this time-honored kabuki dance that goes on between the critic who is arriving and the restaurateurs and the chefs who are there. They notice you, but they don't want to telegraph the fact that they notice you too much. you know that they notice you, but you don't want to act like out of the normal and be sort of preened over. You're trying to act normal, but while you're doing that, you are sort of surreptitiously trying to order half the menu, right, which is not what normal people do.
Yeah, isn't this a kind of transitional period for food criticism as much as it is for any form of criticism, in that the evaluative function has been taken over by the internet? And this goes hand in hand with a restaurant not being able to treat certain patrons like crap because they'll immediately go to Yelp or Chowhound or whatever they are, Urban Spoon, and rat them out. So I would imagine that what you're in the business of now is describing what an ambient experience, a theatrical experience of eating at a restaurant is like, and much less a thumbs up, thumbs down. So anonymity is really irrelevant at this point.
I think anonymity in an ideal world is great. It's just, I mean, it's really a whole new world. I mean, in the olden days, you'd have the critics like Ruth or Claiborne or Gale, and there weren't that many of them. And they would wait 2 months, 3 months before anointing a restaurant, right? We anoint this restaurant. And usually it's a restaurant that even a knowledgeable eaters hadn't heard of, or they'd heard of, but they didn't, you know, they certainly didn't know what to eat there. And so this was a sort of a magic show that went on. Now with the internet, obviously, you go to a restaurant. I'll go to a restaurant that's been open for even 2 weeks, 3 weeks. It's mobbed already.
Right.
The younger eaters are much, much better informed and much more independent. And of course, the internet makes that, you know, times 10. You know, they aren't that swayed by critics, although I think they enjoy reading critics. They're very knowledgeable about critics, and they find critics that they like and don't like, but they really make their own decisions. And that, you know, that's Yelp, that's Instagram, that's all the, you know, all of the social tools that go to making us all critics in this day and age.
Yeah. All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show. The piece is in New York Magazine. You can find it on the internet. It's called "Hi, I'm Adam Platt, Your Restaurant Critic. Why Am I Abandoning My Disguise?" Adam, thanks for coming on. We hope to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, now is the time in our show where we endorse.
Before we endorse Steve, I have one announcement, entreaty, plea for our listeners. Can I interject?
I'm okay with that.
So we very kindly have been nominated for a Stitcher Podcasting Award in the category of Society and Culture Podcasts. Up to you to decide whether we are about culture or society. But more to the point, it's up to you to vote and to make us podcast victors. You can vote once daily. I don't think they count cross-browser either, so feel free to try from multiple devices.
Stuff them ballot boxes, people.
Yeah. But go to stitcher.promotw.com, and you will be able to vote for all the podcasts you love. But hint, hint, please vote for us.
And we'll include a link on the show page.
Yes.
I'd say we're low culture and high society.
Love it.
All right. Moving on. Dana, what do you got?
Yeah, in relation to our conversation with Adam about food criticism, I'm going to recommend the second volume of Ruth Reichel's autobiography. She, of course, is the food writer and former editor of Gourmet Magazine, former critic for the New York Times, and a great food writer. And she has a three-volume autobiography, which is sort of in between memoir and cookbook. All three volumes are great. The first, about her childhood, is called Tender at the Bone. The second is Comfort Me with Apples, about her young adulthood. And then third, fairly recent one, is about her experiences as a food critic, including a disguised food critic called Garlic and Sapphires. They're all great fun to read and, you know, full of fun recipes. But Comfort Me with Apples, I think, is my favorite, if only because it has the most sex in it. It involves a love triangle between her first husband and the man who became her second husband, and the foods that she ate with each of them, and eating chocolate cake with her lover in a hotel room. And it's a very sexy, fun, food-filled book.
All right, Julia, what do you got?
I'm endorsing something slightly existential this week, which is the experience of looking out of plane windows. You might think that this experience has not changed significantly since the dawn of the age of flight, but I would argue that it has, thanks to technology. For one thing, many planes that you now fly on have that awesome map feature. Because of that, you're able to see and determine what you are flying over. So one of the longtime experiences of flight is you see mysterious features or fixtures or man-made or natural below you, and you're trying to piece together what they might be. And I had a great experience flying back from vacation a couple days ago, where in the middle of Nevada, I saw this bizarre array. It looked like aliens had landed. It was a tower surrounded by a circle of reflective devices that seemed like they were bowing down before this obelisk in the desert, in the sands. I was able to look it up. I was able to see on the map that we were near Tonopah, Nevada, and then I Googled Tonopah and found on Wikipedia that one of the nearby features of Tonopah is the Crescent Dunes Solar Energy Project, which it turns out is this thing. And it sounds crazy. The project includes 17,500 heliostat mirrors that collect and focus the sun's thermal energy to heat molten salt flowing through an approximately 650-foot tall solar power tower. It looked marvelous, and I was able to learn so much about it thanks to the beautifully wired world we lived in. The only possible improvement could be if Scarlett Johansson herself had told me this over my earpiece.
I love it. Okay, well, both of you are home cooks, yeah?
Yeah, to some degree.
Do you guys like the Smitten Kitchen website and cookbook?
Yes.
All right, I'm here to endorse it. So the Smitten Kitchen, I don't know anything about it, but I know that I use it, and it's a great cookbook. It's written by Deb Perelman, but I also love her website, smittenkitchen.com. But what I'm really endorsing is her granola bar recipe, which is frickin' amazing. And I made it the other day, and it was the best thing I've ever eaten. My kids were just crazy for it. So,
Steve, our listeners know your granola judgment is though, so how are they supposed to take you seriously on this one?
Look, you can ignore me at your own peril, as always. Fine, if you want to eat tarted up, coconutty granola. But anyway, this isn't my recipe. This is Deb Perelman. So you want to come down on someone, come down on her. Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Always a pleasure.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. Or you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app, where you can just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Fuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around.